All right, what Principia Mathematica is remembered for might be boiled down into a couple of things. First, according to Russell and Whitehead, from a minimum of logical concepts, we can develop pure mathematics without resorting to any kind of Platonic notion of number or rule. That is, if you begin with logical concepts, you can develop pure mathematics. So math grows out of logic, intellectually speaking. Everything reduces to logic, and we can account for the principles of math in that way. Russell and Whitehead are also known for, in this book, dealing with certain paradoxes. To put it in Russell's way, the paradox of the class of all classes which are not members of themselves. That is, if mathematics is going to be developed in terms of classes and classes of classes rather than in terms of Platonic forms, then you have to address the possible paradoxes that arise from the use of class theory. You all understand what a class is in mathematics, correct? So here on the board, I'm going to try to give you a paradox. In the first place, you can have a class of certain kinds of things. Let's say the class of dogs. We can have a class of carrots as well. A class of all things which are carrots. And on and on and on. So you know what a class is, a grouping. All the things which are dogs, all the things which are carrots. Now that's a class. Now, is there also a class of classes? Yeah, so we have a grouping of dogs, we have a grouping of carrots, on and on and on. We also have a class that's all the classes of things. So here we have a class of classes. Now, when we universalize a class of classes, when we use a universal notion, we can run into certain paradoxes. If we talk about the class of all classes, the class of all classes, then there are two types of classes, well, many types, but two types you want to think about here that would be included in the class of all types of classes. In the first place, there are classes which are members of themselves. Right? Is the class of dogs a member of itself? It is? The class of dogs is a dog? Now, think clearly here. Wake up. These are easy questions. Is the class of dogs a member of itself? No, it's not a dog. All right. But now, is the class of classes a member of itself? Of course, the class of classes is itself a class, and so it's a member of itself. Well, now, what about the class of all classes which are not members of themselves? Now, this is a notion that needs to be made sense of if you're going to, you know, rigorously, analytically, and logically analyze everything into logical principles and develop math from it. If math is a matter of class theory, or the use of class theory and classes of classes, now what will you do with the class of all classes which are not members of themselves? I wonder if you can see the paradox here. The class of all classes which are not members of themselves either is or is not a member of itself. And write this down for him. The class of all classes which are not members of themselves. those classes which are not self-inclusive. So let's ask, is this class, the one mentioned here at the beginning of the description, is this class a member of itself? It either is or it isn't. Now, if it is a member of itself, then it's a class which is not a member of itself. So if the answer is yes, then the answer must be no. So if it's a member of itself, if the class of all classes which are not members of themselves is a member of itself, then of course it is not a member of itself. But now, if the class is not a member of itself, you have to remember this is the class of all the classes which are not members of themselves, so then, yes, it must be a member of itself. And so that's the paradox. This notion, which Russell and Whitehead must deal with, the class of all classes not members of themselves, proves to be paradoxical. If it is, it isn't, and if it isn't, it is. And this led then to the conclusion that a self-referring statement must be of another type, must be of another type than the statement itself. Self-referring statements must be of another type. Or to put it in another way, whenever you have a class that refers to itself, you're not talking about the same kind of thing as the class deals with. You're working at a higher level. The class of all classes is not a class of the same order as those classes. You have a different type of class, if you will. And this is what's known as the theory of types. Bertrand Russell, Albert North Whitehead are credited with resolving this kind of paradox by saying that the statement or the concept, the description of the self-referring class has got to be considered of a different order or a different type than what it's referring to. The paradox of the liar is another way in which Russell got into this. The paradox of the liar comes from the Bible. You know that Paul says that all Cretans are liars and they themselves have said that? What he says. If all Cretans are liars as they themselves have said, then the one who said that is a liar. In which case, you can't count on the proposition that all are liars. Okay, so this is the paradox of the liar. And the resolution is to say that Paul's remark, or the remark that all Cretans are liars, must be of a different order than the Cretan who spoke the statement, all Cretans are liars. Or else you have a paradox that can't be resolved. Okay, well, I've taken more time than I wish to. Principia Mathematica, Whitehead and Russell deal with the origin of math, developing it out of logic and class theory, and they are known for the theory of types as a way of resolving self-referring paradoxes. Let me give you some more bibliography on Alfred North Whitehead. In 1919, he wrote the book Principles of Natural Knowledge, and in 1920, The Concept of Nature. And in these books, according to him, nature should not be construed in terms of a dichotomy between what appears to us and then what is the real nature of things underneath the objects that cause them to behave the way they do. How does this book appear to you? Does it appear to be particles? No, it doesn't. In fact, it appears to be colored, in this case yellow. It appears to have other kinds of sensory things which are not true of particles at all, atoms, right? Whitehead said we shouldn't, however, distinguish in nature, draw a dichotomy between the way things appear and the way things are in terms of a causal
nexus that's beyond the appearances. Rather, nature is simply an account of perception. Nature is as we perceive it to be. And he offered a four-dimensional structure of overlapping events. Now that's the crucial thing you want to catch on to, overlapping events. This book that I hold before you is really events that are understood in four dimensions, right? You know what the three dimensions are? What's the fourth dimension? Time. Okay, so in terms of physics, this four-dimensional matrix that is reality, there are events that we encounter. That's nature, rather than nature being these particles organized in a way that give an appearance, the appearance not being what they really are, nor does the appearance account for their causal features. Okay, I'm going to finish the bibliography and then look more in detail at this event orientation to reality. 1925, Whitehead wrote Science and the Modern World. In 1926, Religion in the Making. And there's just an interesting tidbit on the side here about that. That was the first book that Cornelius Van Til reviewed in his career. So he took on Whitehead, first of all, Religion in the Making, 1926. 1929, Whitehead wrote Process and Reality. In the same year, he published The Function of Reason. In 1933, he wrote Adventures of Ideas. In 1934, Nature and Life. 1938, Modes of Thought. And in 1947, Essays in Science and Philosophy. Now I realize you probably can't write all that down. You better have some idea of what he wrote. But I want you to be impressed with the breadth as well as the number of topics that he wrote on. And he did it with great erudition. What is Whitehead's process philosophy all about? First of all, over against Bergson, Whitehead should be remembered for reaffirming the capacity of reason to know reality. Bergson was an intuitionist. He said you can't trust reason. Reason distorts the flow and fluidity of the elan vital. Whitehead, on the other hand, reaffirmed that reason is capable of knowing reality. However, if we're going to get it right, we have to have a new categorical scheme. We have to use different categories than previous philosophers have. And this, of course, is the brilliance or the downfall, depending on your perspective. But this is the creative contribution of Whitehead to 20th century metaphysics. He said we shouldn't be using the categories of substance or object, but rather we should create a metaphysics based on the generalized concepts of modern physics. That in itself shows another difference with Bergson. Bergson was impressed with science, but he was a vitalist, and so biology gave him his metaphors, if you will. Whitehead, on the other hand, is impressed with science and wants to develop a metaphysic from it, but it's physics that he thinks is the most fruitful way to organize experience and to understand reality. So he wants to introduce a new categorical scheme. If we use what he called imaginative generalization, we can come up with categories, a category scheme that is applicable to all experience. And the most important category that we will use in accounting for all experience is the category of what he called an actual occasion, sometimes called an actual entity. But I think occasion is probably more helpful to you at this point. The category of actual occasion will replace the traditional notion of a substance. Let's think for a minute of the traditional notion of a substance. An object that I encounter, let's say an apple, the way most philosophers, substantival philosophers, have thought about it, there is something that underlies the attributes of this apple that we call the substance of the apple. We never see the substance, though. All we see are the accidents of the apple. And what are the accidents or the incidental attributes? We see that it's red or green, depending on whether it's a Granny Smith. We see the color of the apple. We see the size of the apple, the crunchiness of the apple, the sweetness or tartness of the apple. These are all attributes, but the apple itself is not one of its attributes, is it? The apple is not redness. The apple is not crispiness. The apple is the combination of all those things. So what is it that combines those? That's the substance. All right, so we have, if you will, a concrete object out here, an apple. And it's thought of as a substance whose attributes will change. The redness or greenness of that apple is going to become brown if you leave it out long enough, right? Whitehead said, we shouldn't be thinking of reality in substantival terms. We should be thinking of reality as events, as processes. And so the category that should take the place of substance is that of an actual occasion. That apple is really a combination of occasions, certain events. Whitehead wanted to apply the analogy from the life cycle of organisms, in a sense, instead of the mechanistic models that were popular in his day. He thought of an actual entity or an actual occasion as a process of self-development. A process of self-development that rearranges the material provided by the background of the process and in turn becomes material for the next generation of events. Now, you're not accustomed to thinking this way, but it's not hard. The language may throw you from it, but stop and think about this. Everything is a series of events, and the events that are taking place are rearranging the material that has been provided to them. That is to say, is dealing with previous events. And when that event, that actual occasion, takes place, it itself becomes material for other events. So everything is in process. One event leads to another, leads to another. And what Whitehead warned us against, and this is language famous to him, he warned us against the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. The fallacy of misplaced concreteness. We commit that fallacy of misplaced concreteness if we think of an abstraction, what is in fact an abstraction, as a concrete entity. The real things in the world are not abstractions like substance and objects and so forth. The real things in this world are actual occasions. They are events, processes. Every actual occasion is seeking its own satisfaction. Every event that's taking place is seeking its own satisfaction. An apple is seeking its own satisfaction? Well, that would make no sense at all if you thought of the apple as what? An object. Well, that's the fallacy of misplaced concreteness. But if the apple is what? A series of events, then yes, those events are seeking their own satisfaction, but on a level below consciousness. That is, he's not trying to say that every event in the world is a self-conscious event in the world. Man is self-conscious, but that isn't to say everything is. But nevertheless, what man encounters in the world are actual occasions, events of things, which below the level of consciousness are seeking their own satisfaction. And so Whitehead does not want to think in terms of mind and matter. Mind and matter are all events. They're different kinds of events, but they're events. He doesn't want to have concepts over here and facts over there, because our concepts, our conceptual thinking, is just an event, And the objects we were thinking about, or what we called objects, they too are just events. In fact, he doesn't want to separate the past, the present, and the future, you know, as though they are watertight compartments. Why? Because everything we call the past are events that have become material for our present, which are events that are going to work their way into the future. So everything is in process. Everything is connected by being actual occasions. The actual object of all of our perceptions, therefore, the most concrete fact of nature, is an event, not an object. According to Whitehead, objects are only abstractions. And as abstractions, they do, quote, ingress into events. That is, my thinking of something as an object is an event. Well, that event does ingress into other events, to be sure, but nevertheless, it's only an abstraction. My thinking in that way is an event, that abstraction. And it does affect, you know, whether I walk over to the table and pick up something and put it in my mouth and take a bite. But nevertheless, I should be thinking of all of it more concretely as events. So an actual occasion is a spatio-temporal occurrence that enters into transactions with other spatio-temporal occurrences. And all of these occurrences are bound together in a unified process. Whitehead had an interesting notion that every event in this unified process prehends or takes account of other events. Every event takes account of other events. And so the event of thinking or knowing is a kind of prehension. My knowing is an event that prehends other events, enters into relationships with other events, takes account of other events. Whitehead said that every event, every actual occasion, has two poles to it. Now here I'm going to use an analogy that might be misleading, but I hope it'll help you. A few moments ago, I said Bergson distinguished between two sides of reality. He was dualistic. He said there's the élan vital, which is like the steam coming out of the kettle. But then there's also the material side of the élan vital, which in terms of the analogy is the droplets of water that fall back from the life force, or the élan vital. Well, Whitehead similarly said every event has two sides to it. Every event has two poles to it. There's the physical pole and the mental pole. But by physical, he didn't mean made up of matter. Now, you know that. He couldn't mean that because what? He's been trying to get rid of this object-substance approach to metaphysics. The physical pole of an event is that part of the event that prehends past occasions. Okay, so an event as it takes account of past events is physical. The mental pole in every event is the creative, free, and non-determined part of the event. So it is oriented toward the future. So every event has a past, every event has a future. Where it's going is free. Where it's been determines its matter, its physical aspects. Okay, so thus far we've learned that for Whitehead, the new category of thinking for us will be events, actual occasions, not substances. We know what the fallacy of misplaced concreteness is. We know that everything is an actual occasion that enters into the life of all other occasions and prehends them, takes account of them. Every event has a mental and a physical pole. We have to add to Whitehead's metaphysics now the concept of eternal objects or essences. eternal objects or essences might be likened to Platonic forms. They're the universals, the permanent and unchanging possibilities. The permanent and unchanging possibilities, which are grasped in various ways by the actual events or occasions that take place. When we have an experience, we observe in our experience certain forms of definiteness, which are, if you will, the possibilities for an event. The predicates of our sentences or our propositions refer to eternal objects, the forms of definiteness. What's the predicate of a sentence? If I say the barn is red, what is the predicate of that sentence? Thank you. It's red. The object of the sentence or subject of the sentence is barn. Now, a barn is a combination of events. Isn't that right? You have the wood event, you know, and all these other things that can be said about barns. Those are all events that make the barn. But when we say the barn is red, we've abstracted an eternal object or essence. Red is a permanent possibility of an event. The subject of the sentence, or what we call objects, are made up of a complex of events, and the predicate of the sentence refers to an abstracted eternal essence, a permanent possibility of an event. So, put it very simply, you have a lot of events mentioned in the subject of the sentence and one event mentioned in the predicate. And that one event is mentioned because it's a permanent possibility of an event. It's an eternal object or an essence. Now, where do we put God in this metaphysical scheme of things? You should be aware of the fact that in the late 20th century, there have been a number of theologians like John Cobb, Schubert Ogden, and others who have wanted to make use of Whitehead's metaphysics and apply it to religion. So they have a process theology, a process view of God. Well, in Whitehead's case, God is a concrete entity. God is a event, an occasion, that includes the world and at the same time transcends the world. To put it simply, all the happenings of the world are part of God's nature. So God is an event made up of all the events of the world, but He's not limited to the events of the world, obviously, because every entity, every occasion has two poles. Do you remember that? The physical and the mental. God's physical pole, that which prehends the past, are all the events of the world as they've taken place. God's openness to the future, God's mental pole, is the freedom of what's going to develop in God's life. And so this view is sometimes called panentheism. Not pantheism, all is God, but all is in God. P-A-N-E-N, then theism. Panentheism. All is in God. All the happenings of the world are part of God's nature. God is a process too. And God has two aspects. The primordial aspect of God will be the eternal objects that are part of His primordial nature, but which by themselves can't account for the novelty, the venturing into novelty, which is part of God's character. According to Whitehead, these eternal objects describe and pertain to God in any possible world. They're completely abstract. But the actual God, the God of our world, has not only that primordial nature with the abstract possibilities, but has a definite nature and definite attributes that come about because of the events of this world. And so the consequent aspect of God's nature over against the primordial aspect of God's nature provides for the retention of all the achieved novelties as the contingent future becomes the actual present.
Okay.
So God is made up abstractly of all these primordial abstract possibilities. But in the real world, God consequently has retained all the novel things that have happened, all the events that have taken place. And so what was contingent and future back in 1820 has now become part of God's consequent nature. It's no longer contingent and future. It's either the actual present or the immortal past. But that's all been retained in God's nature. Think of God as a big snowball. Okay, as the snowball rolls down the hill and gets bigger and bigger, it's retaining all of the creative things that were happening in the snow that it has gone over. God is the accumulation, you see, of all of the novel things that have happened in the past that are happening in the present. And yet, there's still a future for God. And we don't know what that is because, of course, free will